Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday. This is the monthly podcast of the Labor Relations Information System on recent developments in public safety labor issues. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next hour or so while we talk about what's been going on in the last 30 days. I promise you, I'm not going to talk about health insurance again. It is becoming a bit mind-numbing watching whatever is going on in Congress. We've now seen, of course, the Americans Health Care Act move on over to the Senate, where the Senate is considering different options that seem to be equally unacceptable to senators on the conservative end of the Republican Party and the more moderate end of the Republican Party. It's difficult right now to see anything passing, although you never know, and therefore I'm not going to talk about it. Even though it does have the potential to increase healthcare premiums by as much as 20% in 1 year. Let's just see where this all goes. We've got a long way to go on it. Instead, what I want to do is I want to talk about five interesting cases. These are from all over the country. We've got a very important case on peace officers' Bill of Rights and civilian review boards. But I'd rather start by talking about sex. We haven't had too many police sex cases or firefighter sex cases. Firefighter sex cases are very rare, and we haven't had too many of any of them in the last few years. I think as society has grown much more tolerant with respect to sexual mores, that we're seeing a lot less interest in law enforcement agencies in regulating the off-duty consensual sexual behavior of their employees. But not everywhere. And there are still some states where you see discipline for employees engaging in consensual sexual activity where there's no relationship to the job. Those states typically are grouped in the South, and also there's a number of jurisdictions in Utah that take exactly the same position. And it might surprise you the attitude that the courts in those jurisdictions feel, the attitude that they take towards these cases. I'm going to talk now about a case that comes out of Louisiana. It comes from the Fifth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. So this is a Federal Court of Appeals case, and it reaches a result that I'll bet will surprise you, and bluntly, I think flatly, would not be repeated pretty much anywhere else in the country. But it's a Federal Court of Appeals that has regional jurisdiction over a number of states. So what's this case all about? It's about a couple of sheriff's deputies in Bossier Parish, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, Louisiana, Brandon Coker and Michael Golden. When the chief deputy of the parish learns that in October 2014, Coker and Golden had swapped houses and swapped spouses without having divorced their current wives, both of them were placed on administrative leave. And the charges against them were basic code of conduct charges. And I'm going to quote a sentence of their charges. The allegation was that they had not conducted themselves at all times in such a manner as to reflect the high standards of the sheriff's office, and that they engaged in illegal, immoral, or indecent conduct, and that they may have engaged in a legitimate act, which, when performed in the view of the public, would reflect unfavorably on the sheriff's office. Let's pause for a moment. The court doesn't get into that regulation, but can we really believe that pretty much any part of that regulation is still constitutional? Sheriff's office employees cannot engage in any illegal behavior? Okay, I'll buy that. Immoral behavior? By whose judgment is behavior moral or immoral? Indecent conduct? What is indecent conduct. Don't engage in any legitimate act which, when performed in view of the public, would reflect unfavorably on the sheriff's office. Well, there's a whole lot of legitimate acts which, when performed in public, might embarrass any employer. That doesn't mean the employer has the ability to regulate those acts when they're performed in private. The fundamental problem with this regulation is a Fifth Amendment issue. The Fifth Amendment has a principle, we don't talk about it very often, that if government is to regulate behavior, it must do so on the basis of standards that are clear and readily understandable to, as the courts put it, persons of common intelligence. This is a doctrine known as the vagueness doctrine. And if a regulation doesn't adequately apprise somebody of what conduct is prohibited or permitted, it may well be void for vagueness and violative of the Fifth Amendment. And I think this regulation, using terms like immoral or indecent, I think that's clearly raises vagueness issues. But there's another problem here. And the problem is a separate constitutional principle known as overbreath. Overbreath means that when government acts in such a fashion as to impinge upon constitutional rights held by individuals, employees in this case, it can only do so to the extent necessary, the minimum extent necessary. If the government regulation reaches too far into, for example, protected speech, or in this case, protected conduct, well, then the government regulation suffers from overbreath and can be held unconstitutional. For whatever reason, this court doesn't look at either the vagueness or the overbreath issues in this regulation. But I digress. Let's get back to Deputies Coker and Golden. The department conducts an investigation, finds out, in fact, that they're living with each other's spouses, and the department notifies the two of them that they must stop doing so. The deputies refused to, and then they were told that they would be considered terminated. Actually, what the department said, you will be considered to have voluntarily resigned your jobs if you don't stop living with someone who's not your spouse by a certain date. The deadline passes. The living situations didn't change. They filed a lawsuit. And they claimed that their termination violated their freedom of association protected by the First Amendment. And they also raised all sorts of charges as to right to privacy and all of that. The Federal Court of Appeals rejects their lawsuit. This is, by the way, a very conservative Federal Court of Appeals. The Fifth Circuit may be the most conservative Court of Appeals in the country right now among the 13 Federal Courts of Appeals. And this is an incredibly conservative three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit, and the opinion is written by perhaps the most conservative judge serving anywhere in the Federal Court of Appeals. So these two deputies, when they saw who their case was argued in front of, or at least when their lawyers saw that, had to have just a moment of realization as to how this case was going to come out. Why do the deputies lose? Listen to some of this text. Sexual decisions between consenting adults take on a different color when the adults are law enforcement officers. Their enforcement duties include, for instance, crimes of human trafficking and spousal abuse that place them in sensitive positions with members of the public. Can I interject a second? You're probably getting the feeling I don't think much of this opinion, and I really don't, but what in the world does human trafficking or do human trafficking and spousal abuse have to do with consensual sexual behavior? At any rate, back to the court's opinion. their, the deputy's, involvement in relations that openly and notoriously violate the legally sanctioned relationships of marriage and family is likely to besmirch the reputation of the sheriff's department and hinder its ability to maintain public credibility. It's not hard to envision how the existence of their cohabitation with each other's wives prior to divorce and remarriage might be adversely used in litigation concerning the deputy's official conduct. Can I digress again? It's not hard to envision how in litigation some parties suing the sheriff's department might use cohabitation against the sheriff's department. Really? Do these judges not understand what's proper and what's improper impeachment? There is no way this sort of behavior could be used to impeach these deputies if they testified, nor is there any way that this material is Brady material. At any rate, the court goes on to say, because of these concerns about the potential for problems, not real problems, potential for problems, we're going to uphold the terminations of these two deputies. Does this result obtain pretty much anywhere else in the country? Not really. You find law enforcement, fire protection agencies interested sort of in a geographic basis on regulating the off-duty conduct of employees. As I mentioned, it's at its highest peak right now in the South. You also find the courts more lenient, more tolerant of that regulation in those same areas of the country. So where I might even expect this sort of result in Louisiana, I could not envision such a result happening in, for example, a New York or a California. And that's not good, right? It's not good that we have different standards for what's constitutional and what's not constitutional, depending on where in the country you live. And the rules should be the same, you would think. Because we are talking about, after all, basic federal constitutional rights. Sadly, that's not the case with our judiciary right now. At any rate, this is a case that I think of as an outlier. Generally, courts will require, before an employer can regulate the off-duty sexual conduct of employees, courts will require the employer to show that the conduct was illegal or that the conduct, if legal, had a demonstrable actual impact on an employer. So, for example, the classic case comes out of Pennsylvania where officers are sleeping with each other's wives and the whole thing erupts into fisticuffs and roll call. That's different, right? You have an actual impact on the workplace. You don't have this possible impact on the workplace talked about in this Louisiana case. So generally, that's going to be the standard in the country. Regulation of off-duty sexual activity, acceptable if the sexual activity is illegal or if there is a demonstrable actual impact on the workplace. Otherwise, regulation of the activity is going to be thought by courts to be none of an employer's business. While I'm talking about discipline, I want to talk about last chance agreements for a moment. There's a case that came out of the Iowa Supreme Court, a firefighter case, that raises kind of a new question about last chance agreements. Before I get into the case, let me give you the lay of the land with respect to these agreements. So what is a last chance agreement? These are used by employers, I think, by the way, very effectively. I think this is one of the most effective disciplinary tools that an employer has. These are used by employers typically with an employee who has made a series of pretty serious mistakes with respect to the job. Often these are used in the case of alcohol-related misconduct, might even be an off-duty DWI or appearing at work under the influence of alcohol. Sometimes you see them used with respect to absenteeism. And they're used with other offenses as well. The pattern that you see is that an employer has disciplined an employee, gone through the progressive discipline process, you know, started with reprimands or suspensions or whatever. And then finally, the employee has done something, whatever the something is, that pretty much everybody who looks at it agrees warrants termination. The classic alcohol case is the employee who has in the past received a 30-day suspension for a off-duty DWI, reports to work drunk a couple of months later. And everybody agrees this is a case that would be appropriate for termination. But the employer wants to give the employee another opportunity to prove himself or herself. So what the employer does is to go to the employee and say, look, here's what we're going to do. We could terminate you, but we're not. We're going to give you a last chance if you sign this agreement, if you sign this contract with us. And you're going to have to live by the terms in this contract. And a last chance agreement typically has clauses like, for example, if it's an alcohol-related misconduct, the employee must go through rehabilitation, sometimes even residential rehabilitation, alcohol rehabilitation treatment, and must agree to remain sober. Every last chance agreement I've ever seen also requires the employee to have no related disciplinary offenses for some period of time in the future, 3 years, 5 years, whatever. The employee typically agrees to a long suspension. So instead of termination, the employee will take a 30-day suspension. And the employee agrees that if there is a repetition of similar conduct within that whatever 3 year, 5 year period of time, the employer can terminate the employee without the employee having recourse to the grievance procedure. That's usually the way these last chance agreements are structured. Last chance agreements in a non-union environment are thought to be completely enforceable, just like any other contract in a non-union environment. There's a twist, though. If there's a labor organization on the scene with the ability to collectively bargain, and the twist is that an employer in a bargaining environment can't reach individual contracts with bargaining unit members about anything that's a mandatory subject of bargaining, and discipline is a mandatory subject of bargaining. That agreement has to be reached with the union. So, in other words, the last chance agreements in a union environment are enforceable, but only if the union has signed on to the last chance agreement. And I've watched this happen many times in different workplaces, and bringing the union in, where some employers might, you know, occasionally grumble about that, actually really works to the advantage of everybody concerned, because the union brings with it the imprimatur of peer pressure, and that actually helps convince the employee that they need to take this fundamental step of changing their lives. So that's the lay of the land with respect to last chance agreements. What's going on in this firefighter case in Iowa, and that's a little bit different? Well, this is a case that involves a firefighter with the Sioux City Fire Department named Larry Whitwer. And in July 2012, Whitwer was arrested and pled guilty to domestic abuse assault. In the criminal sentencing, Whitwer was granted what's known as a deferred judgment, and the court also extended a previously entered no contact order with the victim of the domestic abuse for 5 years. The day after Whitwer pleads guilty, he's placed on administrative leave by the fire department and given a pre-disciplinary hearing. At the hearing, or before the hearing, the fire chief talks with a representative from the fire union about what can we do about Whitwer. Everybody agrees Whitwer could be terminated, but the chief and the union rep talk about a last chance agreement, and they end up entering into a last chance agreement. Whitware, of course, signs on. And for 13 months after that, Whitware continues to work as a firefighter without any incident at all. However, November 2013, police are dispatched to Whitware's home. The complaint is that he's texting and attempting to meet with and otherwise reach the victim in violation of the no contact order. Officers looked at the text message, confirmed that the no contact order was active, and arrested Whitware. A court found him in contempt, sentenced him to 2 days in jail, and the department terminates him. And he challenges his termination. And here's the question the Iowa Supreme Court has to address. There's a Civil Service Commission on the scene, and the Civil Service Commission has the authority to review all discipline in the fire department. Discipline isn't grieved through the grievance procedure in the collective bargaining agreement. It simply goes through the civil service system. And the question is the last chance agreement valid without the Civil Service Commission having approved of it at the time it was entered into? And the court actually takes a long, long look at this, looks at last chance agreements in the federal system under something known as the Civil Service Reform Act, looks at case law from around the country, and reaches the unanimous decision there's nothing about the civil service process that prohibits a last chance agreement so long as the employee, Whitware in this case, is knowingly and voluntarily waiving their prospective civil service rights, their rights to challenge the eventual termination through the last chance agreement. The court points out that a bunch of state courts have reached the same result. Last chance agreements are a valid waiver of civil service rights. And the court also addresses an argument that Whitware made that a last chance agreement really isn't enforceable because the municipality, the city in this case, retains complete discretion over whether to offer the agreement. And the court isn't buying that. The court says Whitware is ignoring the fact that he had an equal discretion to reject the agreement. He could have contested whatever discipline was going to be imposed for his first conviction for domestic abuse. He chose not to do so. And the fact that he had that discretion and the city had that discretion to enter into that agreement, that doesn't in any way undercut the validity of the last chance agreement. The court ends up saying we're satisfied. Whitware entered into this agreement knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. It gave him a very significant benefit. He held on to his job instead of with only a five-shift suspension in lieu of termination. Whitware's lawyer may not have been present, but he looked at the last chance agreement, and there was no objection raised to the lawyer's absence at the ultimate meeting when the last chance agreement was entered into. Therefore, termination upheld. I think this is an interesting case because you just don't see these civil service last chance cases coming down the pike very often. We're pretty used to them in a union environment and used to, you know, the notion that you have to get the union to sign on to these. And I do want to close my discussion of this topic by reiterating something I said earlier, and that is these last chance agreements can be really, really powerful. I've seen them work many times. I've seen employees where I thought this employee was headed to ruin, not just with respect to their career, but with respect to their lives, and then have watched as chiefs, fire chiefs, police chiefs, have sat down in the same room with the employee and the union, and the chief and the union are on the same page and look at the employee and say, this is it. This is your opportunity to turn things around. And if you don't take it, there's nothing we can do to help. And that becomes just an incredible incentive for the employee. And so I'm a big proponent of these last chance agreements. I now want to get to a really important case out of the Florida Supreme Court on civilian review and statewide peace officer bills of rights. Probably should have led off this podcast with the case, but unfortunately I got diverted by the spouse swapping story. So this is a case that comes out of Miami. It's the first case I've seen in the country to take a look at this issue, and it's a very thoughtful decision by the Florida Supreme Court, and it's causing all sorts of consternation in Florida. So here's what's going on. The city of Miami has what's known as a civilian investigative panel. They call it CIP. And it's an independent body that investigates and reviews alleged police misconduct, reviews police policies and procedures, and has the ultimate authority to make recommendations to the local law enforcement agency. I'm going to call it a civilian review board just because that's a very common nomenclature, even though they call it CIP there in Miami. This whole case starts on March 5th, 2009, when the Civilian Review Board gets a complaint against a lieutenant, Freddie D'Agostino. And this is for misconduct that had occurred the day before, alleged misconduct, during a traffic stop. The complaint is investigated by the police department's Internal Affairs Division, and it interviews the complainant, Lieutenant D'Agostino, and two other officers who were present during the traffic stop. And IA ends up with a inconclusive disposition. And in Miami parlance, what that means is there's insufficient evidence to either prove or disprove the allegations. And in D'Agostino's case, the IA report says, look, there's no independent witnesses. We've got the police on one side. We have the civilian witness on the other. The police are saying one thing. Civilian witness is saying another. So we are not going to sustain this charge. Our finding is going to be inconclusive. Enter the Civilian Review Board. The Civilian Review Board issues a subpoena to D'Agostino, ordering him to appear before the review board to testify. D'Agostino sues. He's seeking to quash the subpoena, and he cites as support the Florida Peace Officers Bill of Rights. For whatever reason, and it isn't clear from the opinion at all, it takes 8 years for this case to make it to the Florida Supreme Court. What the court has to decide is, how does the Civilian Review Board, how does it function in the context of a statewide Peace Officers Bill of Rights? Now, just as a side note here, there are, by my count, and this count could be wrong, 17 states that have police officer and or firefighter bills of rights. They run the gamut from being a very, very simple to much more elaborate. Certainly, in terms of protections afforded employees, the most powerful in the country, I think, is in California's, in California, followed by Maryland's. I would put Florida's on the continuum of brief to very detailed. I'd put it on the very detailed end of that continuum. It's not quite as pro-employee as California or Maryland, but it's up there on the list. And the court's having to decide how does the civilian review process fit with the whole issue of the Bill of Rights, and in particular, how does subpoena power, as it pertains to the officer under investigation, fit with the Bill of Rights. And what's the problem? The problem is that the Bill of Rights has all sorts of provisions, as do most, regulating when and how interrogations of a law enforcement officer is conducted. It talks about who conducts the investigation, the time of day when the investigation is conducted, who can be present in the room. It has all sorts of procedural protections that deal with interrogations of an officer. And the court ends up saying, we can't reconcile the subpoena power, at least as it pertains to the officer under investigation, with the Bill of Rights. Why? Here's a quote from the court, and you'll get a feel for what the rationale of the court is. Any holding otherwise would render the rights conferred upon officers by the Bill of Rights meaningless because the Civilian Review Board would provide the police department with a mechanism to circumvent the operation of the Bill of Rights protective measures, ultimately rendering the Bill of Rights an initial investigatory protection facade. Ooh, you just gotta love good writing when you see it, right? Initial investigatory protection facade, that's just wonderful. Back to the court. Thus, to uphold the Civilian Review Board's authority to issue subpoenas to officers in connection with investigations of their conduct would impermissibly countermand the rights conferred by the Bill of Rights on the officer. So in other words, what the court's really worried about here is that you could get a city that ends up just making the initial investigation done by a police department just making it very perfunctory, if it existed at all. And you could vest the real authority to conduct interrogations with a Civilian Review Board, which wouldn't be subject to the Bill of Rights. And the court says that undercuts the Bill of Rights to the extent that it would render the statute a nullity, at least with respect to the protections that are accorded to the officer who is being charged. Therefore, says the court, we can't uphold the subpoena authority by a Civilian Review Board. The court closes with, I think, some pretty incredible comments about the subpoena authority of a governmental body in general, and in particular, Civilian Review Boards. Listen to these words. This is only about three sentences. The power to issue a subpoena to a citizen and to enforce it with the power of contempt is among the most powerful tools a government may wield. If we were to hold otherwise, nothing would preclude the formation of other bodies similar to the Civilian Review Board by other governmental units with concurrent geographical jurisdiction over an officer, all empowered with subpoena authority, and potentially subjecting an officer to repeated governmental pressure over an extended time, rendering the limitations in the Bill of Rights meaningless. So the court ends up holding that the extension of subpoena authority to Civilian Review Boards is unconstitutional. Wow, wow, wow. We've only had one case like this, kind of, sort of, before. It's a case that comes out of Denver, and it was decided by the Colorado Court of Appeals, but it wasn't decided on the basis of a Bill of Rights. It was a complicated question as to whether a Civilian Review Board in Denver could use subpoena authority to compel an officer to talk and do so without violating the Garrity Rule. And the court in that Colorado case, it's about 10 years old now, said that under Garrity, in order to compel somebody to talk, a governmental body has to be able to use its threat of disciplinary authority. You have to be able to say to the employee, either you're going to answer my questions or you'll be fired. And the reason you have to say that is that's what triggers the Fifth Amendment's protections. That's what triggers the notion of immunity under Garrity, that the statement can't be used by the government to criminally prosecute the employee. And the court in Colorado said civilian review boards don't have the authority to discipline officers. Therefore, they don't have the authority to force them to talk. That's the only other case I've seen on this issue. But I will bet that you're going to see law enforcement officers, and to the extent that the civilian review boards get involved in fire protection agencies, firefighter unions, around the country in those states with peace officers' Bill of Rights, I'll bet they're going to take a look at a close look at this case out of Miami to see whether or not subpoena authority in their states comports with their statewide peace officers' Bill of Rights. Big decision, maybe the biggest decision on a peace officer's Bill of Rights I've seen in the last 5 years or so. I want to close by talking about really a hotbed of constitutional litigation about pensions, police and fire pensions. What's going on right now in California is really pretty amazing. There's a collection of cases that are either at the California Court of Appeals or the California Supreme Court or are heading there that are going to be decided, and in one case, or several cases actually have been decided, that could have a dramatic impact on the pension rights of public employees in California. Certainly the biggest of these cases is one involving Marin County, California. This is a case the California Supreme Court has accepted for review in 2016. The case should be decided by the end of 2017. And that's a case in which retirement benefits were cut, and they were cut for existing employees. And the question that the California Supreme Court has to decide is that acceptable under the jurisprudence of the state of California? California for many years has had something that's called the California rule. And the California rule is something expressed by the California Supreme Court that if you're going to cut a pension benefit to existing employees whose pension rights have vested, or to retirees, if you're going to cut in one area, you're going to have to add in another area so that the net impact on the pension is roughly zero. It has to be kind of a zero-sum game. The California rule's been around for a long, long time. The Court of Appeals, which is, of course, below in the chain of command to the California Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals in the Marin County case found that the California rule really didn't apply anymore, basically overturned it, and said words to the effect of employers can cut pension benefits for existing employees, and they can make deep cuts in pension benefits for existing employees so long as the core to the pension is still present. And the Court of Appeals didn't really define what it is that core is. So that whole case is headed up to the California Supreme Court, that one, and there's actually a companion case, on the question of what sort of cuts, if any, are allowable in the pension benefits, the eventual pension benefits, of existing employees whose pension have vested. That's, I think, by far the most important of the cases. There's another case that's headed up to the California Supreme Court. I don't think the court has decided whether to review it, so I think the case is still pending. It comes out of San Diego, and this is one where you had a voter-approved cut in pension benefits, and the employees or their unions demanded a bargain over the change in pension benefits. And that case went through California's Public Employment Relations Board, which held that because of the significant involvement of the mayor in getting the voters to cut back on pensions, that, in effect, that was the employer, not just the voters, changing those pension benefits, and it had to bargain. And the California Public Employment Relations Board basically overturned the results of the vote. And a Court of Appeals decision in that San Diego case rejected CalPERB's view of that and upheld the amendment that cut pensions. That case set it for the California Supreme Court, which again may or may not decide that case. So those two cases, you know, standing alone are, you know, huge developments in pension law. The one I'm going to talk about right now, not so much a huge development, but I think it shows the general trend that you're seeing in California right now, which is that what people there have thought as traditional protections of pensions may not be as solid as they might otherwise think. So this is, as I said, this is a more minor case, but probably not if you're actually involved in it. This comes out of Monterey County, California, and the Monterey County Deputy Sheriff's Association has negotiated what's known as a Memorandum of Understanding. That's California's version of a collective bargaining agreement. The Sheriff's Association has an MOU with the county that has a longevity payment in it. It's actually called a longevity performance stipend. It can only be received by employees who have 20 years on the job and a satisfactory or outstanding performance evaluation. And if they meet those criteria, they can get an additional stipend of up to 8%. The county is a participant in the statewide retirement system known as CalPERS. And the county has never reported the longevity stipend to CalPERS, and therefore, two things have happened, or not happened. First of all, there's been no pension payments on the longevity stipend. And secondly, retirement benefits, retirement calculations, haven't been based on the longevity pay. Well, a group of deputies notice this, and they bring a lawsuit, saying that longevity pay should be included in their retirement calculations. And that issue goes to the California Court of Appeals. And the court ends up saying this. It's a very statutorily focused decision where the court is looking at individual words that are used in the statute and what the meanings of those words are. And as fascinating as that would be to talk about for like the next 15 minutes, I'm going to pass over all that and just do the rough English language translation of what the court had to say. The court says, look, what we're looking at is what's compensation? What does that term mean under the retirement statute? Because retirement benefits are based on compensation. And compensation is a term of art. And it includes regular compensation, wages, but it also includes, under the retirement statute, special compensation. And there's a particular definition of special compensation. And it is only, that under the definition, special compensation is only these things. Pay received for special skills, that's not longevity, knowledge, it's not longevity. Abilities, not longevity. Work assignment, work days or hours, or other work conditions. The statute, says the court, goes on to say special compensation doesn't include anything else that CalPERS has not affirmatively determined to be special compensation. Some of you are saying, wait a minute, didn't that statute say that special compensation includes additional pay for other work conditions? Isn't longevity another work condition? Good question. And actually, the court's opinion doesn't really deal with that at all. What the court focuses on is whether longevity pay has ever been determined by CalPERS to be special compensation. So the court puts together all of the pieces of this statutory scheme and finds that they clearly and unambiguously say that compensation only includes payments that CalPERS has affirmatively determined to be special compensation. The court says it's undisputed that longevity has not been included in that list. And there's nothing in the language of the statute defining what compensation is, and nothing in the past practices of CalPERS that indicates that a form of incentive pay that combines longevity and bonus pay is special compensation. Therefore, even though there's a performance component to this longevity pay, remember you had to have received performance evaluations that were satisfactory or outstanding, even though that exists, this isn't going to be included in the calculation of retirement benefits absent an affirmative listing by CalPERS. And of course, in this environment, particularly with events in California concerning the rates that employers and employees are paying for pensions, it's not likely CalPERS is going to change its mind on whether any form of longevity pay is included in special compensation. No word yet on whether or not this case, it's only weeks old, whether this case is going to be appealed to the California Supreme Court. But I think all of us around the country have to have one eye peeled on what's going on with respect to these retirement issues in California. Frequently, you see that whatever happens in California today is going to be argued and litigated about in a lot of other places in the country in 3 to 5 years. California is the harbinger of labor issues and coming to the fore elsewhere. So let's keep an eye peeled on California. Well, with that, I want to thank you once again for joining me for this podcast. It's always a pleasure to do these things. It is sort of an odd enterprise, not knowing who's listening, and I hope everybody's getting a good deal out of these podcasts. And we hope you join us for our next monthly podcast in August of 2017. Also, we have a seminar on communications for police and fire unions, communication in this modern day and age, social media day and age, that's coming up in August in Las Vegas. If you can make it, we hope to see you there. And with that, have a great initial month of the summer. This is Will Aitchison signing off.